What Women Know. Revised from two talks given at the Winter Fish Trap Gathering in Joseph, Oregon in February 2010. Each talk preceded open group discussion of the topic. The first evening. Our topic for tonight is, what do we learn from women? Many of us find ourselves surprisingly defensive on the subject of how men's and women's roles differ, how gender is constructed and enacted. Since generalizations about human behavior are easy to derail by bringing up exceptions, I suggest that to keep our discussion profitable, we footnote the exceptions. We're entering the forest of gender, where it's awfully easy to get lost. If we keep foregrounding a tree here and a tree there, we'll lose sight of the very big dark woods we're trying to find a way through. So, in answer to the question, what do we learn from women? My first huge generalization is that we learn how to be human. Over the millennia, in all societies, right up to now in Oregon, women have supplied most of the basic instructions on how to walk, talk, eat, sing, pray, play with other children, and which adults we should respect, and what to fear, what to love, the basic skills, the basic rules. The whole amazing, complicated business of staying alive and being a member of a society. In most times and most places, babies and little children have been taught predominantly, often solely, by mothers, grandmothers, aunts, neighbors, village women, preschool and kindergarten teachers. And this continues in America now. Every time you see a young mother with her kids in the supermarket, you see a life scholar, a teacher teaching an incredibly complex curriculum. Whether she does it well or not so well doesn't affect the rule. Most of the time, it's she who does it. The basic skills she teaches are largely genderless. Boys and girls both learn them. As they become social skills, they may be colored blue or pink, as when a girl is taught to be quiet and civil among adults, while a boy is taught to yell and pester, or when a girl is praised for dancing with flowers on her head, while a boy is shamed for it. But overall, the elemental skills and manners taught by women obtain for both genders. By contrast, what young children learn from men is often gendered. Men may be more interested than women in making sure the pink and the blue don't mix. Fathers often teach their children sex roles. The boys how to be manly, the girls how to be womanly. Men often take over the teaching of boys entirely as the boys grow up, while ignoring further education of girls. For thousands of years, the education of girls has been almost entirely domestic and female, and still is in many places. Men teaching girls who are not their own daughters are mostly a quite recent phenomenon. For thousands of years, male priests laid down the laws outside the house. The father of the family enforced them inside the house, teaching little or nothing to the daughters but obedience. The general rule has been that, after age 6 or so, boys learn from men and girls learn from women, and the more absolute the gender division and hierarchy, the purdah or Sharia law, the truer that is. By teaching only male knowledge only to boys over a certain age, men have left women the major role in teaching young children the manners and morals of their people, how to be human without reference to their sex. And here lies, perhaps, a fertile ground for change, even for subversion. The teaching of the fathers tends to maintain hierarchy and uphold the status quo. Social and moral change may begin with women, who have less invested in the hierarchy, as they try to teach their kids how to adapt to new circumstances. I think of the covered wagons on the Oregon Trail. While the men filled the traditional role of aggressively defending their women from strangers assumed to be hostile and dangerous, the women, often surreptitiously, it appears, talked with Indian women, bartered a little with them, left the kids free to nose around one another. The rigid white male story excluded the strangers. The opportunistic white female story began to admit them. A vast amount of what we learn as story. We hear and read and learn the myths and histories that tell us who we are and who we belong to. The fireside tales that tell us about our immediate people, our family, the official histories of our tribe or nation. Who tells those stories? Who do we learn them from? Over the centuries, it's been the women of the family who kept alive the stories of who our family is and how members of the family, our immediate tribe, behave. Male priests, shamans, leaders, chiefs, and professors taught the stories of who we are and how we should behave as members of our larger tribe, our people, our nation. Women transmit the individual stories. Men transmit the public history. Again, the men's teaching is likely to support the status quo, while the women's teaching, being individualistic, is more likely to be subversive. The two teachings can be contradictory. For example, the public male story I learned of how the West was won was about men exploring, leading wagon trains, leading cattle drives, hunting and killing animals, hunting and killing Indians. The stories my great-aunt Betsy told me of her early days in the West were different. I remember Betsy's story of driving away from their burning ranch house with everything they owned in a one-horse wagon. Or her story of how her older sister Phoebe, my grandmother, then 12, looked after her little brothers in the cabin on Steen's Mountain during the Indian Troubles, while their parents made the 3-day trip to town for groceries. The Indians, displaced and harried by government troops, were hostile, and Phoebe was afraid of them. But in the version of the story I remember, nobody hunted or killed anybody. The public male teachings and the private female teachings may differ, and the differences may be confusing. As when a single mother in the inner city teaches her children the story that society expects them to respect themselves and behave as honest citizens, but what they learn from the young men who are the leaders in the streets, and all too often from teachers and policemen, is that they are characters in a story that allows them only one role, to be addicts and criminals, useless or worse. Or when a family brings up its sons in a story of living in peace and with mercy, but then a male institution, the army, puts them into a war story where they are driven to kill and be cruel without remorse. Or when a mother includes her daughters in a rich tradition of skills, such as cooking and housekeeping, but then businessmen and politicians persuade them that in the story of capitalist society, such work has no value at all. It is not even called work. A very frequently repeated story tells us that women, innately unadventurous and conservative, are the great upholders of traditional values. Is that true? May it be a story men tell in order to be able to see themselves as the innovators, the movers and shakers, the ones who get to change society's ways, the teachers of what is new and important? I don't know. I think it's worth thinking about. The second evening. One of the props that has supported the dominance of men in our society and culture is the idea that great art is made by men, that great literature is by and about men. When I was in school, women, teachers working, as teachers must, within the male hierarchy, taught me this. And then men taught it to me in college. The really important books are by men, and men are at the center of the important books. However, my mother, who was not a feminist and would disavow any subversive intentions, gave me lots of books by women, including Little Women and Black Beauty, and later on, Pride and Prejudice and A Room of One's Own. When I began to write fantasy and science fiction, that genre of literature really was all about men. Very few women wrote it, and its women characters consisted of a princess here and there, a pretty girl screaming in the tentacles of a purple alien, or a pretty girl batting her eyes.
Oh, Captain, please explain to me how the temporestrial figillator works.
So even though I'd given my heart to several great women riders as well as several great male ones, and welcomed the appearance of actual women characters in science fiction, for a long time, I didn't question the idea that fiction was about men, what men did, what men thought, because I didn't really think about it. However, along in the 1960s and 1970s, those fearsome feminists with their bonfires of bras were thinking and asking questions. Who gets to decide what's important? Why are war and adventure important while housekeeping and childbearing and child-rearing are not? By then I had not only written several novels, but kept house for years and had several children, all activities that struck me as fully as important as anything else people did. So I began to think, if I'm a woman, why am I writing books in which men are at the center and primary and women are marginal and secondary? As if I were a man. Because editors expect me to. Reviewers expect me to. But what right have they to expect me to be a transvestite? Have I ever even tried to write as who I am, in my own skin instead of a borrowed tuxedo or jockstrap? Do I know how to write in my own skin, my own clothes? Well, no. I didn't know how. It took me a while to learn, and it was other women who taught me. The feminist writers of the 60s and 70s, the women authors of older generations who'd been buried by masculinist literary establishment and were rediscovered, celebrated, reborn in books like the Norton Anthology of Women Writers, and my fellow fiction writers, mostly younger than I, women writing as women, about women, in defiance of the literary old guard and the genre old guard, too. I learned courage from them. But I didn't and still don't like making a cult of women's knowledge, preening ourselves on knowing things men don't know, women's deep, irrational wisdom, women's instinctive knowledge of nature, and so on. All that all too often merely reinforces the masculinist idea of women as primitive and inferior, women's knowledge as elementary, primitive, always down below at the dark roots, while men get to cultivate and own the flowers and crops that come up into the light. But why should women keep talking baby talk while men get to grow up? Why should women feel blindly while men get to think? Here is a character in my novel, Tehanu, expressing her belief in gendered knowledge. The central character, Tanar, and her friend Moss, an old, poor, ignorant witch, are discussing male wizards and their power. Tanar asks, "What about women's powers?" And Moss says, "Oh, well, dearie, a woman's a different thing altogether. Who knows where a woman begins and ends? Listen, mistress, I have roots. I have roots deeper than this island, deeper than the sea, older than the raising of the lands. I go back into the dark." Moss's eyes shone with a weird brightness in their red rims, and her voice sang like an instrument. "I go back into the dark. Before the moon I was. No one knows, no one knows, no one can say what I am. What a woman is, a woman of power, a woman's power deeper than the roots of trees, deeper than the roots of islands, older than the making, older than the moon. Who dares ask questions of the dark? Who'll ask the dark its name?" Over and over, women are heard and read by both men and women as saying what is expected of them, even while saying just the opposite. That speech has been quoted 100 times by people approving it, endorsing it. Never, I have seen a reader or critic pay attention to what Tanar answers. "Who'll ask the dark its name?" says Moss, a grand rhetorical question. But Tanar answers it. She says, "I will." And she adds, "I lived long enough in the dark." Moss is saying what a masculinist society wants to hear women say. She's proudly claiming the only territory men leave to women, the primitive, the mysterious, the dark. And Tanar is refusing to be limited to that. She lays claim to reason, knowledge, thought. She claims not only the dark, but also the daylight as her own. Tanar speaks for me in that passage. We've lived long enough in the dark. We have an equal right to daylight, an equal right to learn and teach reason, science, art, and all the rest. Women, come on up out of the basement and the kitchen and the kids' room. This whole house is our house. And men, it's time you learn to live in that dark basement that you seem to be so afraid of, and the kitchen and the kids' room, too. And when you've done that, come on, let's talk, all of us, around the hearth, in the living room of our shared house. We have a lot to tell each other, a lot to learn.